Record on this computer. So I'm recording now. So good morning again, just for the video use. So we're gonna start with dynamic programming one. And I have said before, I will give you an introduction and then give you two examples about subset sums. Okay, so let me head over to the slides. So we are in a second here on the slides. So first of all, let me arrange the screen a little bit. Okay, so that's that, I guess. Okay, so I can watch the chat and everything always. Oh, there's popping up another question. In the quiz of Divide and Conquer 3, the first two questions, what are the answers? Okay, let me try to answer that quickly before we move on, because then we can focus on the rest. So it is Divide and Conquer 3. Yeah, now you cannot see the browser, but I'm going to Divide and Conquer 3. And the first two questions are asking, what is interpolation of a polynomial and what is evaluation of a polynomial? Yeah, that's, I think that are the two questions you want to know the answer for, right? Divide and Conquer 3, yeah, that's it. Evaluation of a polynomial is just the, going from the polynomial, given its coefficients, to the evaluation of the polynomial at a couple of points. That's evaluation. I mean, that's mostly almost elementary. Let me see if I can take here a quick a little corner over here, right, and put that here on the slides for today. Okay, you have a polynomial which is like, I don't know, a of x is the sum over all the guys from 0 excluding n ai to the x to the I. That's a polynomial, right? Now, so you're given here the coefficients ai. You know these guys, and then you want to evaluate the polynomial. So in the context of the fast Fourier transform, actually you want to evaluate it at several points. So we had used, I think, n minus 1 points here. So that's evaluation here. So the short answer would be basically the evaluation of the polynomial is, well, it's almost redundant. It's finding the value of the polynomial at given positions, if you want. Okay. Okay, the quiz asks for a number as an answer. Really? Does it? Oh my God, okay. Okay, sorry. Yeah, that's a bug in the quiz. Okay, that makes no sense. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I see that now. Okay, I don't know what happened there. I didn't. Oh, okay. I see. Yeah. Okay. That's maybe. So maybe it's not me again explaining what's the evaluation interpolation. So, but okay, just to finish that evaluation, then would be getting from some points to the values, and interpolation would be the other one. Okay, you have the points and their values, and you want actually the coefficients a. I to AI n minus one. That would be the short answer. So the short answer would, I would have expected some text like, okay, evaluation is given some volumes x, find the value of the polynomial at the positions x. And interpolation is given the volumes of the polynomial at some positions x, find the coefficients of the polynomial. Okay. Sorry, I will fix that. Okay. That maybe is the problem with the quiz, right? Okay. I think, okay. Okay. Does it, well, I think that answers the question. I hope so. If not, yes. Okay. I will check that. I probably have to check. I wasn't aware that when I'm creating the quiz, there's kind of a short answer flag. And I put the in short answer. I wasn't aware that it's a type restriction, or that I had enabled the type restriction for that. Okay. Well, okay. So let's look at dynamic programming. There's lots of stuff here in dynamic programming in the book of Kleinlab. And let me make a little bit of an advertisement for dynamic programming. I mean, I have said that in the beginning, at some point, greedy algorithms are nice and beautiful and easy to understand and almost never work. So there are very few problems how problems you can solve exactly with the greedy algorithm. But they're simple to implement. They are often used. They have some utility. Dynamic programming, however, is really powerful. Probably, in my opinion, at least, it would be from the three techniques, maybe the most complicated, but maybe the most powerful. So divide and conquer comes up sometimes. It's nice to know, but it's, in my experience at least, not so common in practice. You do it sometimes, but dynamic programming comes up all the time. All the time. I don't know, from 10 algorithms I do in my papers, 8 are dynamic programming algorithms, something like that. If they are not simple heuristics. Maybe I'm exaggerating here a little bit, but dynamic programming is extremely useful. So it's extremely useful if you get your head around that. That will be like seeing solutions with dynamic programming will be an extremely useful skill. When you have algorithmic problems, so that's maybe something you can see at the beginning. So what we're gonna do today is basically this one here, 6.2 principles of dynamic programming, memorization or iteration. I won't talk about weighted interval scheduling at the moment, at least squares. I'm not sure if I will talk about that, but I will talk also about subset sums and knapsacks because they're so elementary problems and they come up all the time. So it will be basically today 6.2 and 6.4. And there's other things I want to show you in the other two lectures. There will be a couple of examples. And memory reduction techniques and stuff like that. So it's possibly, we will certainly see a sequence alignment. Maybe let me put this another color here, sequence alignment. We're gonna see and sequence alignment in linear space via divide and conquer. We will see too. That's very important technique. On the other stuff, I'm not sure if I will show everything of that. Maybe, very possibly, I will show you also discuss in the next lecture weighted interval scheduling. That's a good example. The secant and least squares. So let me put it like this. Very possibly, secant least squares. Maybe, maybe not. And this guy here, RNA secondary structure. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe shortest path. But they will have also other examples which I think are useful. So maybe the subset of stuff we see is a little bit different. There will be a good intersection, but there's lots of stuff I can't possibly explain you all the material. It's important you getting the main ideas, and maybe it's even better if you see other examples because then you can ask me and we can see this. And for the rest, you can have a look at the book. Okay, so that's the plan roughly for today. And well, I hope you were able to see the video lectures. Also, thanks. I think it was Jago, which made me aware again. I have, so one of the videos was truncated and MP4 is like, if there's not the complete video, you don't get it. And the upload has been interrupted at some point and they were missing like 15 megabytes at the end. So that was good. Thanks for alerting to that. So all the videos should work. And well, the videos cover an introduction, a toy example, which is Fibonacci, which I'm gonna try to repeat quickly and then the two examples. So let's just have a look at that. So basics of dynamic programming. I tried to to sum up this in this slide here. Usually the point of the starting point is a recursive definition that is similar to what divide and conquer. So you take a problem and break it up into subproblems. And that recursive definition will lead you to a recursive solution of the problem, like just a call tree. It's the same as we did in divide and conquer, but there's a little catch. So you have your problem over here, and you see it can be solved by dividing it into subproblems, this guy or this guy or this guy. And then recursively you move on, right? So these subproblems here have generate other subproblems and so on and so forth. And at some point you hit the base cases over here, and then it recursively pops up again to the solution of the whole problem. Okay, that's similar to divide and conquer. However, the main criterion is a large overlap in subproblems. So it is possible. So if you look at this graph, actually, it is possible that these two guys here, okay, let's put it like this, lead to the same subproblem. Maybe I should draw it like this. Okay, let me make this even more clear. These two guys call the same subproblem. And then the whole subtree over here is computed twice in this example, because you have a recursive call over here, like let me put this in green, right? There's a recursive call coming over here, and there's another recursive call coming over here, but it's later in time. When you're in the first recursive call here, you don't know that it will be called later, and then you backtrack to there, and you come over here, and when you're in the second recursive call over here, you don't know that this has been called before, because it just don't store the information. And that's exactly what you do when you do dynamic programming. You have a overlap, you recognize that there is an overlap, but you have lost the information. So you try to not lose that information. So you have that overlap, and then caching makes sense. So to avoid that effect of doing it two times, you introduce a cache. That means on the first call, you don't know if that subproblem will be called a second time or not, but on the first call, you take, okay, that's a volume here, you store that volume in a cache. And on the second call, when you come over here, you just pick up the volume, because it's the same subproblem again, okay? That is possibly the main idea you should be looking at. For not losing yourself maybe in the detail of the problem and finer technical stuff, okay? So it's simple to see. You have a recursive definition. The problem can be solved by breaking it down into subproblems, one, and you have overlapping subproblems. And then it makes sense just to store them. Okay. Does that make sense on a high level? Okay. Maybe give me a quick yes or something, or formulate a question. Okay. I see a couple of yeses. That's a very, very high level idea, but it's useful to see what's going on. The next thing, or two more details then, the complexity first of all follows then. If you have a cache, you need to know what is the size of the cache? How many subproblems are there? You can count that. And in the worst case, you will fill the whole cache, will store the value of every subproblem. The size of the cache then gives you the memory requirement, or the space complexity of your algorithm, because you need to store all that cache. And that's a major trade-off of dynamic programming. But dynamic programming, then, as you can see, and we have talking about it in the video, it trades time for space. Instead of calling it two times over here, you're calling it once only, but then you have to store, you have to use memory. So you have less time, you need less time, but you need more memory. That's also something to have if in your mind, because the cache has to fit into the memory, or the number of subproblems cannot be too large. In general, if you have an exponential number of subproblems, that's probably too large. There's some exceptions. Subset sum and knapsack are part of these exceptions. That's one thing, because you can always wait longer, right? Time is like flows into the future if you want, right? You can always wait longer. I mean, you cannot wait 200 years or something, but in principle, you can wait. But you cannot, you have only limited memory. I mean, if you have 20, 32 gigabytes in your main memory and the cache doesn't fit, it doesn't fit, and the algorithm terminates. So you cannot wait for more memory or something like that. And you can swap, but then your hard disk has a limit and so on and so forth. So memory is limited and it has to fit. That is a hard limit for the size of the problems you can handle. Different from time, that it's just waiting long enough, in principle, at least. Okay, so we have the memory requirement, and then if you look at the size of cache and multiply it by the time for filling each cell, then you get also the overall complexity of the problem. So usually it's simple to find that. If you have the subproblems, you know how many subproblems are there. And this gives you the size of the cache. And then you look what it takes to fill it in. And then you get the space complexity. So different, that's interesting, different from divide and conquer. We won't be using Akrabasi and all that stuff over here. We don't need it. We have a different way, a much more simpler and much more direct way to compute the complexity. That's one consequence. It's easier to find the complexity. The other requirement you have is the optimal substructure. Optimal substructure means you can solve the problem by the subproblems, by solving the subproblems and combining them in some way. So you're gonna analyze a couple of subproblems, and at least one of them has to give you the solution for the whole problem. For decision problems, subset sum is one of these. So it's a question, yes and no question. The subproblems must cover all possible cases. For optimization problems, then, one of the subproblems must be extendable to the optimal solution. That would be optimal substructure. Right? The subproblems are the substructure. And the optimality is we can find the optimal solution for the complete problem by taking one of the subproblems at least and extending it to the so the optimal solution of one of the subproblems and extending it to the complete solution. This would be the main argument for correctness of a dynamic programming algorithm. So it's like, it's again an inductive argument that's similar to divide and conquer, or the same match. You show that it works for the base cases, and you show that given the optimal solutions to the subproblems, you can find the optimal solution to the whole problem. And then you're done, okay? Does that make sense? Maybe I'm like gonna clear here and you hit the yes, or could you show this extended part? Oh, the extended part, we will see that. I mean, I will come back to that, Marcio, but I will give you a high level example. Okay, high level example would be the high level example is just a drawing. Okay, you have this whole problem P. You say, okay, I don't know, I have this sub problem here. I chop off a part of it, so that's my sub problem P line. And now you solve this sub problem optimally, so you have the optimal solution. S line star to that subproblem, but that's not the solution for the complete problem. So you have to take that and add something over here to get the solution for your whole problem. That would be what I call extension. Okay. The idea is by solving the subproblems, you are able to solve the whole problem too. But you have to do another step. You can compare this to divide and conquer. Okay, divide and conquer was the same thing, right? You divide it into subproblems, and then you have the left part and the right part, and whatever, you solve these subproblems, and then comes out something. Think merge sort. Okay, you have a merged sequence and a merged sequence like this. Okay, and then you have to merge the two sequences in together. Okay, an extra step you have to do. There's one important point I wanted to mention also. You will see this in the examples. Divide and conquer very often has a set of elements, like merge sort again, think merge sort, and you cut it into the middle. So the left part are the left elements and the right part are the right elements. And then these two subproblems are completely independent. And it's easy to see that in this case, there won't be an overlap of subproblems. Dynamic programming in this sense is often much more speculative. You have several subproblems, but you don't know which one will lead to the optimal solution. And it's not that you solve all of them and combine them to the complete solution. Left half and right half. Often they are overlapping, and you just make guesses what the subproblem may be. And that leads to an overlap, and that leads to the efficiency of caching. Okay. And Jose is asking, since the cache needs to store all subproblems, complex analysis does not account for cache misses. It does. What happens is this, it's like, okay, we will see this again, maybe later, okay. But let me make a very simple example, okay. There are two subproblems, and these two guys have two subproblems again. However, these two guys share it. And maybe, to make it like this, okay. These two guys, or these three guys now have the same. Yeah? So if you make that in a naive sense, that would have have death three. So there. So this part here in a naive sense would be computed twice. Now, what usually happens is if you look at the first subproblem, this one over here. If you know the value of this subproblem, so if you know the value of subproblem one and you know the value of subproblem two, then you can compute the value of the whole subproblem in polynomial time. So that would be poly time. But then the time is, so let's call this f of n, if you want. Something like that. But what happens it could be F of N. That's okay. What happens in No, okay. Yeah, we will see this thing. It's better to maybe to explain the examples. But okay, what's the cost here? And you have the cost for one, you have the cost for two, and you have the cost f of n for computing, given these two values, the complete solution. What we're gonna do is and after computing this, I will fill my cache over here with that volume. That may be not interesting because that's the whole thing. But what I'm doing is I'm attributing the volume f of n to that node. So in the first call, when I come there is no volume there, and that's the cache miss. The test that the volume is empty is order of one, so that's included in my f of n for the first cache miss. And then I see, oh, I have to make the recursive call here that costs one and gives me a solution, and I make have a recursive call here that costs two and gives me a solution, and then I combine these solutions or extend these solutions somehow with cost f of n to get the volume v, and then I store it here. But what I'm doing is I'm attributing, since this is part of my cache here, this cell here of my cache has cost f of n. Because the cost down here, or maybe I take this in green, the cost here and the cost there, the cost for computing the subproblems, I will attribute to these cells over here. Okay. So if and for that's the reason, Jose, that we have the cache miss. I see the cache miss that costs constant time. It's if usually, or cache is empty. Then you make the calls, but the calls don't count for the current cell. The calls count for their cells, for their subproblems. Then you get the result of the subproblem back. You combine it somehow, and we see very, very often it's a constant cost. It's like a sum or or something like that. And then you attribute that merge cost if you want, or that solution extension cost to the cell. And that's the reason why we can at the end have the number of cells or the number of in the cache times the cost of computing a cell given the problems of the subproblem, the volume of the subproblems, or the solutions of the subproblems again. So there will be and it's not a cache like a computer cache. I mean, the computer cache, that's maybe that could be confusing. Okay, computer cache is small. Okay, and we have been talking about another cache algorithm when you have a couple of elements in the cache and then come new elements and you throw out other previous element, and then you can something which has been in the cache before can be thrown out, evicted from the cache again, and then it gets a miss again, and it will be computed again, and so on. That's not the case here. It's not a cache in that sense. We store everything forever. So there will be exactly one miss one time, and then we compute the subproblems, combine their solutions, and store it in the cache, and it will never be forgotten again. The cache only grows if you want. Okay. That's also different. So I've tried to make the principles of dynamic programming more clear by using a very, very simple toy example. And I want to quickly repeat that, but it's maybe better to spend more time on subsets and knapsack because the Fibonacci is simple. Sometimes I feel it's too simple in the sense that you see immediately what's going on and you don't see the principle. So as I have in the videos, I have emphasized several times, don't get confused by the simplicity of the problem. So it is only for illustrating the principles. It's very simple to compute Fibonacci numbers. And well, you have the definition of them over here. It's just like the base cases are one and one for Fibonacci, 0 and 1. And then you keep summing the two previous elements, right? The second one is 2, the third one is 3, and the fourth one is 5, and the fifth one is 8, and the sixth one is, 13, and so on. Okay, that's a recursive definition. So we have here the solution of the problem, if you want, already. We have been talking about, you have a recursive definition. I give you that already. And we are looking only at the caching part. Recursive definition, the dependencies, we have seen that a recursive definition leads to a recursive algorithm like this. Now for the base cases, n is, let me do this in red, n less than or equal to 1, return 1 as the definition above it gives you. Otherwise, you call fib n minus 1 and n minus 2. And that's exactly the situation you usually have for a dynamic program. Recursive definition, that's a subproblem. In this case, you sum the solutions of these two subproblems, but they lead to a large overlap. Okay, so we have been seeing this in the video, just to look at very quickly. A call for F5 will call F3 and F4, but F4 then will call F3 and F2, and here you already have the first overlap. So without doing anything, you will compute F3 twice. And that will lead to a huge, huge overlap in subproblems and to a huge cost. And you recognize that. And what you do is you put there a simple cache. The simple cache is this. You fill it in with unknown values. So that will be the misses at the beginning. But a 0 and 1 are known. So you can put this in the cache already. It's base cases. And then you do the test during the recursive call. Here you're accessing the cache. And if the value of the cache is undefined, that would be a miss. That's what we've been talking 2 minutes ago, right? That would be a miss, and that costs something, right? It's an order of n here for testing that. And also that miss then will cost you the sum here. So we have the test and the sum here. That's for the miss, which leads to filling the cell. And you do that by calling fib. Oh, that doesn't come out so well, so let me put it in by hand. So by calling fib n minus 1 and fib n minus 2. But the cost for computing fib n minus 1 and fib n minus 2 is attributed to other parts of the algorithm, to other cells, to other cache cells. Because to do that, fib n minus 1 is computed by either accessing the cache of fn minus 1. So that's maybe directly in the cache of fn minus 1. And you return the cost all of 1. Or you will compute it recursively. That may happen. And the same over here. So here's the miss cost plus the evaluation cost of that cell. That would be order of 1 in both of these cases. Okay. So that's the let me put this down, cost per cell or cost per element of the cache. Now on the first time, you find that you have a miss, you compute the value, and from now on it's there, and you can just return it. So if you would call fib n a second time, you would just get the value in order of 1. You look at the cache, and let's make this in maybe a while here. So look at the cache. It's not undefined. It's defined already, so you don't do nothing. Just go here and return that one. Okay. And then you get the cost per cell. And the cells are these guys, right? They are also for all n's, or the number of cells would be n. So you get a cost of order of n here. For time and space. because you have n cells and you need n time. That's what happens. Yeah. And you can always do this. So if you have that, if you have a recursive definition like above, here's super simple, okay. But okay, it's a recursive definition. The correctness is here, by the way, okay. The correctness, just to emphasize that. I mean, here it's only given. There's no correctness to show. That's the definition of Fibonacci numbers. There's no correctness we have to show. Later we have to show correctness for the problems we want to solve. But here's just definition. But correctness follows inductively by the recursive, from the recursive definition. And the complexity follows from the number of cells times the cost per cell. And then you can do, you can always do this, and you get then, you just introduce a caching layer, and that's called memoization. You just make, you store all the values of your recursive calls, and when you come to the same recursive call a second time, you just use the one. You don't call the subproblems again. Okay? That's a very basic strategy. And that happens, that can be done with every dynamic programming algorithm. Always. But people don't do it because it's a more efficient, there's a more efficient way of doing that. But anyway, let's stop here a second. Is that okay? Does it make sense? Clear this up. Maybe you'll give an okay, or you'll come up with a question. Seems okay. Okay, that's clear. Yeah, good. That's good. That's important to keep in mind. Recursive definition, inductive proof, cost, number of cells times cost per cell. And you're good. The algorithm would work already. What's sometimes confusing or makes the thing more complicated, maybe more complicated than it should be, but it's more efficient, so people like to do it like that, is to look at how the cache really evolves and then to fill it in, not recursively with memoization, but sequentially. In the toy example of Fibonacci, it's almost too simple. Let's have a look at it. What will happen is you will fill that cache from the right to the left. Because F5 is undefined at the beginning. For this, you need F4 and F3. But this is undefined also. So F4 will call F3 again and F2, but it's also undefined. So you will call maybe F3 again. And this will call F2, which is undefined, and finally there's something. But you need also F2 for F3, so F2 will be called first. And now F2 can terminate. F2 can indeed see 1 and 1 and sum it and fill in F2. So F2 will be the first to be filled in. And then comes F3, and then comes F4, and then comes F5. So you can see that actually you just can fill the cache from right to left in this case. Or from the smaller volumes 0, 1 to the larger volumes. And when you see this pattern, you just make a sequential implementation which uses it. So you put F0 and F1 to 1, and then you fill it up from 2 up to N. Just set Fi minus 1, Fi minus 2. It's very simple, and that's the definition of Fibonacci numbers again. And then you return the fun one. And you get the same result. At the end of the cache, F0 to F1 is filled with the correct values. So little f i equals capital Fi. So the ith element in the cache is the ith Fibonacci number. And in this case, you're interested only in fib n, so just return fib n. This can be, I would say, almost always done too. It can be done very easily if the dependency pattern, just like in Fibonacci, is simple. You can recognize what's going on, and then you fill the cache in a simple loop or in a double loop and a triple loop or something like that. Depends on the structure of the subproblems. And then comes a final twist here, which will come up in the third lecture. Again, it's not so important over here, but well, okay, let's look at the cache again. For computing, for computing, maybe I do this in red here, for computing F2, I only need F1 and F0. But then I have F2. But then for computing F3, I only need F2 and F1. Then I have F3, but for computing F4, I only need F3 and F2, and so on. And then you see that you don't need the whole cache all the time. You need indeed just a sliding window of that cache with the last two elements. And that's almost a trivial observation in the Fibonacci case, but you can throw away these cache elements and maintain the last two. If you do that in the Fibonacci case, you get this small and compact algorithm. That's maybe the way you would implement it anyway. Just have two volumes. So in this case, the space complexity is now order of one because you have only two volumes. The time complexity, however, maintains the same. So what you did here is a space reduction. You have been trading space for time, and in the end, we reduce space again by observing that we need only a subset of the elements in the cache. This can be often done too, but it's often much, much harder. So you have to work more because, and we will see this in subset sum and knapsack, you need the cache to extract the solution usually. If you throw away part of the cache, you usually get only the answer, like true and false or a volume or something like that, but not the complete solution. Okay. The cache could be implemented a vector in this last case. Yes, yes. The simple answer is yes. because it has a single index. In this last case means in this one, I guess. Yes. So the little f is a vector. Small f is a vector. With n plus one elements, f0 to n fn. That's a vector. Yes. In general, that's very often the case. We will see subset sum and knapsack. There, it's not a vector, it's a matrix because we have two indices in the subproblems. And there may be even more complicated subproblems. In general, you can also always use a cache in a map data structure, which maps from the subproblem description to the volume. So in C++ or in Python or whatever, you could use a map. And then it's a hash table. The cache always could be implemented as a hash table, which is, so in this case, it could also be, if you want, a hash table from the integers. A hash table which is indexed by integers. So a map from int to int in this case. But that would be too complicated. Here it's a vector. You have two indices as a matrix, but it could be also a map from pairs of integers to values. And if it's more complicated, we'll see more complicated examples, then maybe it's the easiest thing to use a map, a hash table. A minimap is implemented often as an unordered map, talking C++, is a hash table. Okay. Is that your question? Hopefully. Okay, good. Let's stop a little bit. Here maybe you give a feedback, a little pause if that's okay with the basic ideas. Senzo, do you want to ask another question? Let's see, okay, a couple of okays. Okay. Okay. I hope that's clear. I mean, it's just, I try to discuss the ideas again. in the context of Fibonacci. And Fibonacci is very simple. It's just like if you're playing football and we're training to make kicks, right? Or you're training to make goals, but it's all among friends, and we're not running. It's not 80 minutes in the game. It's nothing like pressure and something like that. It's just Fibonacci is like this. Okay, we're making standard situations in football. We're putting the ball there. Trainer so talking something like, and now we're going into into a game if you want. Okay, yeah, so here is subset sum, our first problem, and then you will see hopefully all these ideas again, but the problem is much more difficult. Okay, so the problem is actually deceptively simple. You have a couple of numbers here, so x1 to xn, and these guys are I use integers here, but the point is so the xi's could be anything, so let's put the integers over here. If I have real numbers with finite precision, it's the same. Point is these numbers can be positive and negative, and the question is just, is there a non-empty subset that sums to zero? This comes up very, very often in practice. There are other subproblems or variants of this problem. You can actually ask for any value here if you want. You're not limited to zero. It's just the simplest variant. You can ask if is there a non-empty subset whose sum is whatever value v. Or you can ask if you take the sum of all the numbers here, okay, xi and divided by 2, you can ask if there is any subset which sums to x, non-empty subset which sums to x, so half of the values. And that would mean that you just split the set into two halves of the same volume, such that the sum is the whole. That's also, these are variants of the problems. That comes up in practice surprisingly often. If you want to make something fit or divide something into two parts or something like that, and the problem is NP-hard, unfortunately, so it cannot be solved easily. And it's simple to see. You have n numbers. The number of subsets is 2 to the n. The number of possible subsets. And if I give you a subset, deciding if the numbers in the subset sum to zero or not can be done if you do it with a simple loop in order of n. So the brute force algorithm would be order of 2 to the n times n. And that's too much. You can't afford that in general. So I guess, let me wait a second. Is it okay? I think the problem is clear. Very elementary problem, very very common in the literature. Now, yeah, okay. So let's apply the logic of that. So if you go a step back, we need to have a recursive definition if you want. Or we need to break that problem down into subproblems. I need several subproblems that I can solve, which help me to solve the whole problem. And here's the main idea or the main thought. If I would know if the first element is part of the solution or not, so if x1 is in or is out, then I had a smaller subproblem I could solve. That's a basic dichotomy, right? Either x1 is in that set or it's not. That's clear. However, I can't decide that. For this, I had to look forward to the solution. I would have to see the solution already. I don't know what's the answer. Is x1 in or not? I don't know. So I'm going to test both of them, just. I try to solve the problem without x1 and with x1, both of them. And then I see what happens. here you may perceive a difference to divide and conquer. So it's not like cutting in half and take x1 to x, I don't know, x10 and then x11 to x20 and trying to do something over there and then summing it up to something else. That would not work in this case. It's very different. I have several subproblems, but only one of them usually gives the right solution. I don't know which one of them is okay. So I try them all. That's my recursive solution. That's the basic idea here. So the logic we're going to see here, that's the main, I mean, if you come to a new problem, which is not subset sum, you have to solve it. You have to come up with such an idea. Okay, that's a hard part. That's a creative part, to see that structure somehow. If you see that, then it's easier to come up with a complete solution. So we see, okay, dichotomy is X is part of a solution or not. If it's not part of the solution, what happens then? Well, then there is a subset from X2 to Xn that sums to zero. Or not. So if the answer would be yes for subset X2 to X1 that sums to zero, then the solution is yes. Otherwise, it's no. Similarly, if somebody told us it is part of the subset, oh, then I know I have to find for the rest of the solution also a subset from X2 to X1 that sums to minus X1. Because then that subset, which sums to minus X1 plus X1, which is in, sums to zero. Okay. So in both cases, I get a subproblem. Just nobody told me if X1 is in or out. I don't know. I have to try both. Does that make sense? That's maybe interesting. Let me clear that. Does it make sense? That's the elementary idea of solving sub problem. Here's the idea. That's the idea part. If you can see this idea, so the rest will kind of flow like Fibonacci. Okay, this makes sense. It's important here also as a side comment while you're giving yeses or formulating questions. It's important to see that the test will occur for both, yes. Because I don't know if X1, I really don't know if it's in or out. If that would be a greedy algorithm, it would greedily either take X1 or exclude X1. The last two points, the suffix and the target one, yeah, I will come to that. I hope, I guess that refers to these two. The negative part is also recursive. Yes, both of them are recursive. Take that. Okay, you have a problem. That says, let's do it like this. Okay, is there some subset of x1 to xn which sums to zero? Let me write it like that. That's a shorthand notation. And now I say, I don't know. Either x1 is out or x1 is in. So let's try both. If x1 is out, I need a subset from x2 to xn which sums to zero. If X1 is in, if I knew that, then I need a subset from X2 to X1, which sums to minus X1, okay? And then Marcia says the negative part is also recursive. Yes, both are recursive because if I have to decide if there's a subset from X2 to X1, which sums to zero, I have almost the same problem again. It's just one number less, but I have no idea what's happening. So I have to, if I knew that X2 is out, I would have to look for a subset of X3 to Xn that sums to zero. But if I knew that X2 is in, but I don't know, I would have to look for a subset from X3 to Xn that sums to minus X2. Okay. On the other hand, here, what you say, the negative part is also recursive. Well, is there a subset of X2 to X1 which sums to minus X1? I have no idea. I don't know even if X2 is in. If I knew that X2 is out, then I would have to search for a subset of X3 Xn that sums to minus X1. Okay. If I knew that X2 is in, then I would have to look for a subset from for X3 to Xn that sums to minus X1 minus X2. Okay. And you can see now we're in the second level. And that goes on and on down to, I mean, there are n levels, right? And if you do this, and the branching factor is 2, so the number of leaves here is 2 to the n. And that's like brute force. You're doing brute force here, okay? Almost. But we didn't do caching yet. In the positive case, will be part of the extended solution because you remove it. Yes, okay. That's a good point to discuss all the rest. So we have a set before you break. So let's look at the first level first. You break your problem zero, down into two subproblems, one and two. And now I said, okay, if you have a solution to the subproblem, you must extend it to the solution of the whole. So if someone says, yes, there is a solution here. So there's a subset from X2 to Xn, which sums to zero. How can I extend this to the whole solution? Well, in this case, it's very easy. I say yes to, I found something. But if I would have a no here, there's still a chance for the right-hand side of the problem. So if the right-hand side here would give me a yes, then I can also say yes. Because I can extend the solution. So the extension here would be do nothing because it's the same set. The extension here would be add X1 to that solution over here, right? That's the extension. So you see here first, it's not like divide and conquer. You don't combine this solution and that solution to a complete solution. Take one of these two solutions and extend it to a complete solution. Only that here in the left part, the extension is trivial, do nothing. And in the right part, you add X1. Okay? Does it make sense? Okay, yeah. So that's the subproblem. So you see how you break it down into subproblems, but you don't make a merge step like left numbers and right numbers and divide and conquer. You look at the subproblem, take one of them. And actually, if you think only in yes and no's for the subset problem, only in is there a subset or not, true or false, then it would be the merge would be just a disjunction. So if you say, well, there's a truth value here, so value of that subproblem, true or false, value of that subproblem, true or false, then the value here is just either the left is true or the right is true. That's in terms of truth values. And the extension we have been talking about, do nothing or add X1, would be in terms of the solution, the set of items which composes the solution, which gives you the sum zero, okay? So I think that answers all the questions, right? Test occurs for both, yes. Except Pfizer's point, the last 2 points, I come to that. But maybe you can see it. But I wanted to point out one other thing that can be seen easily here. I had said, okay, these are N levels, and down you have 2^n leaves, and you get something like a complexity of 2^n if you make that algorithm. So why is this better than brute force? And the answer is it is not. It is just like brute force, just a tree search. It's brute force. But when we introduce caching, we can reduce the number of subproblems, and we will see there are much less subproblems. Okay. To give you an example, here we can see this already here. What happens if x1 is x2? Well, the same volume, both are 5, say. Note that then these two subproblems are the same in this case, because minus x1 is minus x2, right? So without caching, we would compute all that tree. So like 2^n minus 2 levels. Again, we would call an exponential number of subproblems again. With caching, we will recognize if x1 equals x2, that these two are the same. And we compute it only once. The first time we come over here, we compute it and we store the value here, yes or no, or the solution if you want. And then the second time, it's for free. The whole exponential subtree. And then if you think about that, there may be more complicated patterns. So x1 plus x2 equals x5, or something like that. Or x1 plus x2 minus x7 equals something. It's very difficult to see how all the combinations of numbers of a limited set of n numbers will come to sums. Okay. But actually, it's clear that, and we have been using this in the video, if you take the sum of all the xi's, which are positive or zero. And if you take the sum of all the xi's, which are negative, then what happens here in the second argument, this volume here, it's called V, will be always between these two limits. Okay, so the number of subproblems is limited. And this makes a huge difference. Let me give you another example. Say we take 20 numbers from the range minus 10 to 10. In this case, we know that there is the range of values that may happen is between minus 200 and 200. So it is roughly, let's call it 500. So it's 401. Let's call it 500. There's kind of 500 values that can occur. But 2^20 is like what's that? It's like a million. Okay. So it seems like this tree has a million nodes or something like that, a million leaves and a million internal nodes. But the number of volumes here we want to create is only 500. And the number of prefixes, note that, and here I come to Pfizer's question. In the first level, I'm talking about x1 to xn. In the second, I'm talking about x2 to xn. In the third, I'm talking about x3 to xn. In the fourth, I will be talking about x4 to xn, etc. So the first part here, subproblem is defined as a suffix of elements. It's xi, xi plus 1 up to xn. It's in the first level, I is 1. In the second level, I is 2. In the third level, I is 4. We always eat some element here. We chop off some element. That's the first part. Okay. So if you go down there, a subproblem is, and that hopefully answers the question further, is defined by a suffix of elements, xi, xi plus 1. That would be the first part over here. That may be difficult to put that on top of that, right? So like this part. Yeah. And a volume we want for these elements, that would be this part over here, okay? And so in our simple example, we can see that we have at most, for N20, we had at most 20, let's make it 21, okay, because it could be the empty problem. Doesn't matter, 21 times 500 possible combinations. So that's roughly whatever that is. Let's say that's roughly 1,000, okay? There are only about 1,000 combinations of suffixes and target volumes, okay? But the tree has roughly 1 MEK elements, and that's very safe, okay? Here are the savings by caching. So that's in a nutshell what happens here. We have a cool, let me point this out here again, a cool recursive idea here to chop it up in subproblems. The subproblems don't overlap, but we can get the solution using one of them. And we recognize already by a simple example like x1 equals x2, that there will be lots of overlap. And actually, if you make a very quick back of the envelope calculation in a simple example with a limited range, we see that there will be kind of a factor of 1,000 we can save. And that will be the case in general. And we can see that it depends on the numbers. It depends on the range of the numbers. Actually, the smaller the range, the more you will save. Because the tree without caching will be always exponential in the number of elements. Okay. So, I think so. Even though it's said that x1 is either part of the solution or not, it's still possible to get a yes on both subproblems. Yes, Guillaume. So that's also true. So we have said here, okay, it will be like the or of that. So it's indeed possible to have a solution without x1 or a solution and at the same time a solution with x1. That can happen. Often it's like the solution only includes or excludes x1. If there's a single solution, say. But many times it will be possible to have two solutions where x1 is in and out. And then you will get a yes on both. But the or over here then will say, okay, yes here and yes there. So it's yes for the whole thing. And you can then extract one solution. Okay. There can be an exponential number of solutions overall. And you cannot list them all. I mean, if you take, say, the set, so x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, x6, x7, and x8. And you ask, and you make it just like this, 1 and minus 1 and 1 and minus 1 and 1 and minus 1 and 1 and minus 1. So the question is there something that sums to 0? And the answer is, oh yeah, many of them. Or every pair, obviously, can be made to sum to 0. This guy and this guy plus this guy plus this guy plus this guy. But there can also take the first four and they sum to 0, and the last four they sum to 0, and so on and so forth. There are many ways to do it. And this would be like a case where you say, oh, is x1 in the solution or not? Oh, well, if I exclude it, there will be still a solution. But if I include it, there will be also a solution. Just take the second element, for example. So there are many, many solutions. But then the goal would be just to decide, okay, yeah, there's a solution. So give me one, please. Maybe the smallest. That's possible. But in this case, you can't list them all because there are too many. That can happen. So it's not always finding the needle in a haystack, like the single solution. That can be, but it need not. Okay. Well, that was a lot of stuff, but a lot of useful stuff, I hope, because that's the logic of it all. If you understand that, I mean, the smart part was like someone came up with this idea, oh, x1 is in or out. And then you see, okay, this gives you subproblems from 2 to n, summing to 0, or from 2 to n, summing to n minus x1. And then you go on and on like this. And you have a recursive definition. And you also recognize a problem with the overlap of these guys. So it makes sense to cache. And that's your dynamic programming. Okay. So let's write that out. So we have done everything without giving names to things. We will do this now. You say, okay, SIV asks for, is there a non-empty subset of xi, xi plus 1 to xn, which sums to v? Okay. In practical situations, Marcio is asking, we almost always implement the cache. Yes, if you let me qualify this a little bit. Yes, it's like dynamic programming is about caching, if you want. It's about recursive problems which have lots of overlap, so it makes sense to store the intermediate results, the results for subproblems in a table or in a cache. Some guys call it dynamic tabulation. Dynamic programming, by the way, is really, really the wrong name. It's confusing. It doesn't make sense. Bellman has invented that, and there's the story that he needed to have a fancy name for his project to get money from the government, and he thought dynamic programming sounds cool, but it's really not. It's not dynamic, and it's not programming. Okay. So it would be maybe a dynamic table or dynamic caching or something like that. Okay. But so answer to the question, it's all about cache. Dynamic programming is cache. So yes, you have it. I mean, if you find a recursive solution of a problem and you see that the problems don't overlap, never. You have a situation like the divide and conquer, and then you don't use the cache, but then it's not dynamic programming. Okay. So let's head to our definition. Well, you can recognize here, so we can see the subproblem is a suffix of elements from I to M in the target volume V, and we call this now out. So we call SIV the subproblem of summing, let's do this again in blue here, SIV the subproblem of finding a subset, a non-empty subset from I to, including N. Oh, that's complicated here. So summing to V. And then we can write it down more beautifully. I mean, the tree drawing here is more intuitive, right? But now I have names for that stuff. So let me do this just again here. This is now S10. And this is S20. And this is S2 minus X1. And this is the subproblem from 3 to the end, 0, subproblem 3 to the end, minus X2. Subproblem gets crowded here, 3 to the end, minus X1. And this guy here is S3 minus X1 minus X2. Yeah, that's the names. how this goes now. And now we write it down, okay? We know, okay, if you want to find a subset of I plus 1 to n that sums exactly to V, there are two ways to do it. Either you find a subset from I plus 1 to the end, so excluding, oh, that doesn't work, excluding I plus 1 to the end, excluding xi, or you find a subset from I plus 1 to the end, including xy, but then the sum must be xy small. That's it. That's the logic we had before, just written down nicely in a recursive definition. That holds for all the i's between 1 and excluding n. It's a strictly less here. Because for the bottom case, we just look at the element. I mean, if you have Sn V, that's just asking if there is a non-empty subset of the set which has only Xn summing to V. So the only non-empty subset is Xn. So you compare Xn to V and you say true or false. So this iris in brackets here, just if this is true, it's true, otherwise it's false. Okay, so that's the base case. And now you have an algorithm. You can implement it directly. If you implement it like this, just like Fibonacci, it has huge overlap and it will cost you an exponential time. But you can introduce a cache. And then it will cost much less. What's the complexity in this case? We have been making the argument before, like here was our calculation. For the first position, so how many subproblems are there? This I can range from 0 up to n. So there are n plus 1 possibilities for the first argument. This V here, you have seen that, can range from an upper bound to a lower bound. And I've been calling this just the difference between this upper bound and this lower bound is m minus m, so times m. Cells, if you want. Or entries in the table. And what does it cost to compute it? So if you look at this one, you have given S these two S's here. So you're just making a disjunction. So the cost per cell times cost per cell, which is order of one. Well, let me put this down here. Number of cells times cost per cell. So this is just order of n from this part times n. And that's much more efficient. Depends on the range you have. So you get the complexity immediately. Correctness is, well, the correctness is here. The correctness is in the discussion of the recursion. Okay. Let me stop here for a second. Does this make sense? Maybe another question, or you'll give me a yes. Okay. That should really be, I mean, what's happening now is, let me see if there come things up. That should be clear, hopefully. It's very important to make that step. We have been taking a long time discussing this problem, so that I think there will be no time for Knapsack, but it's very similar. I would like to take the last 5 or 6 minutes to show you how I can do the sequential implementation of this. That's interesting. That makes it more efficient, and that will lead to space saving later. We could possibly implement a space saving here. And so we won't be talking about knapsack, but it's very simple. And we took our time to discuss this because that's important. That should be, you should fix that in your mind somehow. If you get, I know that it's sometimes difficult. So I try to go over the Fibonacci and in this case, very slowly. You have to come up with this idea of dichotomy, element is in, element is out, and then it goes forward in this manner. If you get your head around this, I think that the rest will be easy. The Knapsack example will be easy to understand. Okay. Good, there seems to be no question at the moment. So so what I wanted to have a look at is the cache in itself. So we have this cache, what I call it, the S, the matrix S. And I call it the matrix because it has two arguments. It is a matrix. And the first argument was, so maybe put it a little bit to the left. So, okay, SIV. And the range of I was from 1 to M. So the I axis here, the lines are from 1 to M. And V has been ranging from a lower bound to an upper bound. The largest, the smallest negative number you can sum with all these elements, and the largest positive number you could sum with all these elements. So the second, the V axis is from lower bound going up all the way to the upper bound here. So that's like this. And here you have your cells, right? So that's column by column and line by line, and you're going to fill in that cache. And what we really want to know is, so somewhere here in between is a zero, because you go from negative volume or zero to a positive volume or zero. And what you want is to know the content of this cell here. We want to know M10. Is there a subset of I equals 1, 2, 3, 4 to N that sums to zero? Oh, sorry, M. It's it's S, right? So that's it. And now you keep filling that matrix. And now you can look at the dependency pattern. Okay, we take a generic volume. Let me put this V over here. Take a generic volume V and take a generic column V and a generic line I. And we look at this cell. This would be the cell SIV. What does it depend on? Its volume is computed by the volume of SI plus 1 V and SI plus 1 V minus XI. So its volume depends on this one. That's the line I plus 1 at the same column V. Plus, and now I don't know what the value of XI is. It could be minus 5, it could be 13. So it could go, there's another color, 5 to the left, or it could go 13 to the right. I'm not sure. Depends on the value of XI, but it would be some other cell in line I plus 1. So certainly this one right below, and maybe some other. So this one maybe. So that would be XI, a distance of XI. Minus XI. Right? So these two cells, if I know the volume of this cell, and I know the volume of this cell, then I know the volume of the current cell, because it's just the disjunction of them. Okay. So I can see a dependency pattern here. I put this again in red. The dependency pattern is this. It goes mainly, the main observation here is dependency pattern goes down. For computing line I need two volumes from line I plus one. Don't know exactly in which column, but if I know line I plus one, I can compute line I. And this gives you a way of filling that matrix from bottom to top. And the last line is known. It's simple to compute. The last line is just the base case. At the column V, which equals to xn, there is true and all the rest is false. So we know the last line, it's all false. False, 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 all false. Except in one column, in the column xn, there it's true. And the rest is all false. Falses, all the way down. And now I can finish that by filling the cache. So I will put just like that, SNV equals XN equals V for all V. And SIV is undefined for all I between one excluding N because we have filled in N and for all for Louise. That would be the, if you want the cache in it or the table in it. And then I've seen the dependency pattern. It goes from bottom to top. So I'm just filling it line by line from bottom to top. I make a for loop. And I'm starting with line n minus one because line n is known already, then n minus two and so on until the first line. And within that loop, I go over all the volumes. So they come from the lower bound to the upper bound. And then I just set what my recurrence says. So I set SIV to the disjunction of SI plus one V or SI plus one V minus XI. And that's it. And now I can return what's interesting. This fills the whole matrix from bottom to top, and then I return it as 1, 0. Okay. And that would be the same as we did in the Fibonacci example, just unrolling the loop, unrolling the dependency pattern of filling our cache for computing all these values. Okay. Makes sense. Over here, maybe, well, it's 12:10, so okay. Oh, sorry, I have I have eliminated two yeses over here. Maybe let's take for the last thing. Is that okay? Does it make sense? Yes, no, hopefully. A couple of yeses. If someone has a question, I would have to answer it. Seems to be okay. So, Yeah, well, so since we're hitting 12:13, so we are already getting into overtime, I think that's okay for today. Actually, the video for subset sum already goes a little bit beyond that. It explains how to eliminate lines and explains the problem related to that. So at the beginning of the next lecture, next Tuesday, I would like to talk about that quickly. Maybe you have a look at the video and come up with some questions, because that's also an important idea. And the Knapsack example I would like to pull over because it's very similar as a complete video, but I also will be happy to answer questions on the Knapsack briefly at the beginning. On the next lecture on Tuesday, but there are many more cool examples that we may have a look at. So I probably won't be talking about explicitly about Knapsack again. But on the other hand, it should be clear. So it's as I said, it's important that this percolates. You get your head around that. If that's clear, Knapsack should be clear. So make sure that subset sum is clear to you. Have a look at Knapsack and make sure that it's clear to you too. If not, we will take the time to discuss it on next Tuesday. If that is clear, I will be happy and we will push on to other examples. Okay. Oh, the pseudo polynomial time and the left to right. Okay, sure, good. So yes, Guillaume is asking why from left to right in the inner loop? Because it doesn't matter. I don't know if the element, so the dependency pattern is unspecified. It could be to the right or it could be to the left. I don't know it. So I take just any order. Any order serves. So actually, I have written this like in a set notation. It just doesn't tell you how you do it. So it could be while I have been using here like n minus one in a fixed sequence. So it could be over here. It could be indeed. It could be lower bound plus one, up to upper bound completely. But it could also be like you go from the upper bound minus one down to the lower bound. Same thing. You could do it in a random order if you want. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Just have to make sure to that. So it's just like take the next best. There will be other problems where it's important to go from the left to the right. Knapsack is one of them. Have a look at the Knapsack. Okay. There you have an order because the dependency patterns only go like to the left always. So you need the left elements or it's a lie. You need only the next line. No, Knapsack is not an example. There will be other examples where it matters. And pseudo polynomial time, next class. Yeah, I think so. That would take, now it's 12:16. Well, that would take at least another 10 minutes maybe to justice to that. So yeah. Yeah, well, I will push that to the beginning of the next lecture too. Okay, so just to make a hint, you can maybe think about that and see it in the video. This time here looks like polynomial, but it's not. It's pseudo polynomial because a subset sum is NP complete, so we don't expect to solve it in polynomial time by dynamic programming. It could be, but this algorithm isn't really polynomial. Just looks like. So it's pseudo polynomial. Okay. So there are no quick questions and answers at the moment. I think that's it. Let me see how we are over here. Yeah, recording is working, so I'm gonna stop recording.